Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Morning, everybody. Welcome. And you know, it says that we talk to everybody in Charlottesville and Albemarle County. And today, we have spread our wings, opened our arms, and welcomed folks from a larger area of the state into the group. We have invited Rachel Bitticoffer in from Christopher Newport University. She's the assistant director from the Wasson Center for Public Policy. You may have seen her all over. She's on television, radio, podcast, talking about elections, politics. She teaches, known as the Doc. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's not every day that we have folks who are, you can find on NPR, Northern Virginia television stations, Richmond radio stations. Where else can I keep going? I mean, brag about yourself for a moment.
There's not much to brag about, I think. You know, I'm just doing my thing. I'm just really fortunate that I took the time to go get, the PhD and really learn about the mechanics of American politics and voting behavior and I'm studying it at a time of great dynamic change, with political polarization having such a massive impact not only on our institutions, but also on the people. And being able to apply that in a new and novel way has made my research, pretty attractive to a lot of media outlets. So,
well, and this is one media outlet where we were so excited that you agreed to come and chat for the hour. Post-election day of 2019, election day, Tuesday, November 5th, and Virginia was certainly a state where all of the U.S. was watching. I saw a quote where Joe Biden said, "As Virginia goes, so goes the nation." What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, if anybody is listening that is familiar with my research will know, but for those of you who are unfamiliar, which I would suppose is a fair chunk of the audience today, let me just tell you, what we see is a nationalized trend in elections. This is what my research is looking at. I argued that after the election of Donald Trump, we were going to see a massive shift in Virginia politics that would first manifest in 2017. And then that would be powered by, we had a lot of demographic change over the last couple of decades in Virginia, and it was trending the state towards the Democrats. But I often describe it as a muscle that was not being totally flexed. And once Donald Trump was introduced into the picture, Democrats became so agitated, especially that under 40 crowd, that they started to up their participation in voting a great deal. And so now we see Virginia really, really shifting. And Biden's right. I mean, the change here in Virginia is a change that's not isolated here. It's powered by upticks in participation in suburban areas all across America that are powered by new voters coming to the polls or voters that were only voting in certain elections before who are now voting in off year elections. And it may not be a huge difference. I mean, so we think about 2015, 30% of the electorate voted. And in 2019, it was only 40%. But that 10-point difference has a real impact on which party is going to be dominating the political system.
So you mentioned your research and predicting these things happening 2 years ago, the blue wave in Virginia, and then again this year with more Democrats taking over in the state legislature. Tell us what makes you, what made you say that, and what has led to that happening. What is your research, just in a basic manner? We only have an hour, not a semester class, to do that.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, anytime I get a whole hour to talk about my research, it's such a blessing, and that's why I said the pleasure is all mine. Usually I'm not afforded the amount of time to really adequately explain. So I finished my PhD in 2015. I wrote my dissertation on political polarization in presidential elections. So I was already looking at the effects of polarization on how candidates behave and on how voters behave. And I noticed that not a lot of people were taking that application yet, and you know, applying this new environment to elections. And so through 2016, I had just started my teaching and polling career here at the Wasson Center, and I was observing that election. And although I was right in the camp of, you know, Clinton will probably win this election, certainly our polling in Virginia was spot on, and Virginia did exactly what we expected it to do, I did say, you know, over and over, you know, if there's an Achilles heel here, it's that Democrats are complacent. They've been in power a long time. They don't see Trump as a viable threat to actually win the presidency. The media narrative is that he's, you know, not going to win. And you can see two things. You could see low turnout and you could see defection of these disaffected Sanders voters at high enough numbers in the right places. You could see a Trump victory, right? I certainly didn't say that publicly, and I don't want to profess any prophetic abilities. I was of the opinion that Trump would lose the election. You know, I was not out there alone saying Trump's going to win, you know. But I had considered those thoughts, and I had lectured on them in class. And so when he did win, I said, okay, yeah, I'm going to go and study this. I wrote a book on the election and attempted to ascertain whether or not those were the factors that mattered. And those were exactly the factors that did matter when we look at the Midwest and those very close elections that were all decided by 1% or less. We had about 5 or 6% of voters in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania casting what we call protest ballots. And that's very unusual. We don't see numbers like that as a product of the deep unpopularity of both the party nominees. And we saw turnout wane in very critical parts of the Democratic coalition. And so I said to myself, you know, I think what's going to happen now is a massive reset. I think the Democratic coalition is going to take from this, wow, I really need to vote. And so we're going to see in this upcoming Virginia election a backlash effect that's going to be massive. And these close elections that have kind of surprised Virginia political watchers, because they've, you know, the polling has often produced, you know, Mark Warner's going to be safe, you know, Terry McAuliffe's going to win, and then the election happens and it's usually a little bit closer than what people had expected. I thought, you know, this time it's going to be a trouncing. I mean, the Democrats are just going to clean it up in the governor's race, and they're probably going to pick up a huge handful of House of Delegates seats. And when that happened, I wanted to figure out if there was a way I could quantify it. And a major driver for this for me was my belief that college-educated voters were realigning much faster than previous to the Democratic Party, that the election of Trump had acted kind of like a spraying gas onto a fire, you know, the propane gas. What you use for a barbecue. And so I went and built a model backwards to model the districts in Virginia using college education and a score to measure partisan, like, polarization that's pretty common in political science research that's developed by the Cook political report called the PVI score. And sure enough, when I built this model, I was able to pretty much perfectly explain the Democratic, you know, vote share in these districts. And so that's what I used to build forward thinking my 2018 and 2020 research. But my 2018 model ended up being, you know, pretty, pretty good at anticipating where Democrats were going to surge months and months and months advance of the election based on this theory of massive turnout and realignment and polarization.
10 minutes after the hour here, Sunday morning wake-up call. our guest today. We're fortunate to have Dr. Rachel Bitticoffer from Christopher Newport University, where she's with the Wasson Center for Public Policy, talking with us today about the election results from this past Tuesday and previous things that have happened in the state of Virginia. Dr. Bitticoffer, I don't think I'm the only one who's ever said that Democrats poll well but have stopped voting strong over the last decade plus. If you take a poll, you often get things that seem to be a lot more on the liberal side, but the conservative votes and the Republicans up until the last, well, even if you count 2016, are who are in office. Can you explain that?
Yeah, certainly can. And you know, keep in mind, what I show in my research, I have a forthcoming piece that I think people are going to find very interesting that show even here in 2017, 2018, and I have no doubt when I crunch the numbers for Tuesday's election, 2019, we are not seeing Republican participation wane. It's staying steady, and it is much stronger in terms of its proportion of registered voter turnout, much stronger participatory rates than Democrats do. So in my research, what I talk about is this surge and decline problem that you're just describing that Democrats have, where there are more Democrats in many landscapes. So Virginia is a great example of that. Certainly not every landscape. Alabama, there's more Republicans than Democrats, but in these competitive swing areas in particular. In the natural world, there are more Democrats, but their participation in politics is much lower because their coalition is made up of groups that people who study voting behavior will tell you are less likely to show up to vote. Young people and minorities, especially non-African Americans, so Latinos, have lower turnout rates, right? So when we think about why it is they poll so strong and then on election day they had weaker turnout, my theoretical contribution is they lacked during the Obama era this threat catalyst, and that's why they just got hammered in those 2010 and 2014 midterms and lost so many seats in state legislatures and in the congressional stuff. And, you know, only because of the robust demographic advantage of Northern Virginia and the growing demographic advantage in Richmond were they able to win those governorships and the Senate races. So that's part of like the long-term demographic movement of Virginia from purple to blue, which is a fact, right? But in terms of like the overperformance we're seeing now, that's a product of the removal of the complacency and the uptick of Democratic participation. But in this analysis I'll be putting out, which is not just in Virginia, it does include the three House races that flipped in 2018, but it's a nationwide analysis, I will show that even with the blue wave in 2018, even with all of the angst that Democrats had and all the enthusiasm, they had a massive turnout surge. The turnout size of the Democratic surge is much, much larger because they had much more room to improve. But ultimately, in every district that I've done so far in this analysis, the percent of registered Republicans who showed up to vote is still higher than the percent of registered Democrats. What made, you know, the 7th, the 10th, and the 2nd congressional districts still flip over is that even though there were, you know, the percent higher turnout rate for Republicans, is that the turnout surge overall for Democrats plus independents, there's a huge turnout surge for independents, and those independents were breaking against the Republican Party. So when we look at, you know, the suburban areas of states like Virginia, those college-educated voters that are under 40, whether they be Democrats or independents, they are breaking against the Republican brand post-Trump.
So, Dr. Bitticoffer, this question, there's two questions kind of tied together, and it's national tied with state of Virginia, so bear with me. But when you look at the state of Virginia on this recent vote as a whole, and red versus blue, there's an awful lot of red to it. When you look at the United States, there's an awful lot of red to it. But when you look at the 2010 presidential election, I believe President George Bush won with electoral votes rather than popular vote. And we know that President Trump won with electoral votes rather than popular votes. So is the country turning blue and just it's the electoral votes which are helping Republicans at this time?
Yes. 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 I mean, we've seen this happen twice in 20 years, right? And it's only happened like a handful of times over the course of the 240-ish years of the country's history. So to have it sequestered twice in 20 years is suggestive, right? But, you know, I think my anticipation for 2020 is that we're going to see it happen again. I think it's very possible that we're going to see anyway a disconnect. I think that ultimately 2020 is going to go to the Democrats, both in terms of the Electoral College and the popular vote. But I think the portion of Electoral College votes the Democrat wins is going to be out of sync with the amount of popular vote margin they win by. So, and the reason why is that, as you pointed out, when you look at these like maps of red and blue, there's so much red, but when you look at a population map of the country, the populations, I mean, almost all of the country's population is centered in very specific sequestered parts of the country, right? So, you know, it has a very distortive effect on that. So, but the Electoral College is a system, a feature of the system that's not going to change. It's a constitutionally designed system. So, if you want to modify or get rid of it, it requires a constitutional amendment. And because it has benefited one party twice in 20 years, it's not going to change, right? It's definitely not going to be something that is altered or changed in any way. So I think it's going to be something that is here to stay. But, in terms of it being out of whack in 2016, it's not often that it can do that, but it can happen. I mean, it certainly, we've seen it twice in 20 years.
Do you ever see it changing the other direction where, I mean, are we talking about 25 years, 50 years where Democrats win by electoral vote but lose the popular vote?
Well, that's a deep metaphysical question, right? Because, I mean, you know, I guess it would depend greatly on what is the future of the party system, because right now, we are in a really fascinating time as a political scientist to be studying party politics. We have one party that started with a internal revolution, the Tea Party revolution in 2009. Then it went through an all-out civil war in 2015, 2016, and that civil war ended basically with the side that, you know, declared secession winning and taking over the party. So, you know, we have a really different Republican Party than we had 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And the party is the party of Trump now. It's not, you know, when we think about who's been excommunicated from the Republican Party, it's in, either you've been excommunicated or you've gotten on board the new brand of more populist and nationalist messaging for Republican politics, right? And that's something I don't think that I saw. I mean, I knew we were headed, the Republican Party was headed into a lot of turmoil, but I didn't think somebody could actually an outsider could come in from the outside. I mean, keep in mind, Donald Trump is not a lifelong Republican. He's a total outsider. And we have forgotten now, because once he became the Republican nominee, you know, to an extent the party rallied around him. But really the coalescing behind Trump happened the day he won the election, that night, the next day. That's when the real coalescing around him occurred. Before that, you know, the party supported him in the election. Paul Ryan, who was then the Speaker of the House, Mitch McConnell, of course, the Senate leader, they supported him in the election. But when we think back to the convention of 2016 for the Republicans, it was a very odd Republican convention. There was almost no party dignitaries at it. Very few would attend even the convention, let alone have a speaking role. And that's why they had to reach out to Ted Cruz and give him a speaking role, even though the level of animosity between Cruz and Trump was, you know, quite high. And we have forgotten a little bit how hesitant the party was to get behind Trump. But once he won, and the understanding of the potential of having, you know, now having a Republican president became, you know, clear, the party did coalesce around him. And then after about a year in office, there really was no delineation between Trump Republicanism and the Republican brand as it is now. I mean, it's definitely a full takeover of the party. So, and we see that trickling down now to the state level, where a lot of the state politicians are behaving in ways that are more similar to Trump-style populism. You know, you see rallies and campaign communications, which are more rhetorically outlandish, I guess I would say, than they would have been previous to the Trump era. So it's possible that we can see great change in the party system. But as far as the opposite of Electoral College popular vote goes, the problem with the new vision of the Republican brand is usually party building is a game of addition, and it's an intentional game of addition, right? With this particular version, it's definitely a game of subtraction in terms of coalition building. So I have a hard time imagining, unless there's a massive reset in who these the party coalitions are made up of the opposite scenario happening.
All right, our guest today is Rachel Bitticoffer. She's a professor, a doctor at Wasson Center for Public Policy in Christopher Newport University. The Doc here with us today for the hour. Hang tight. And back in action today, Sunday morning wake-up call, talking about Tuesday's elections, how we got there, what happened, and where we're going. Dr. Rachel Bitticoffer here with us today. Thank you so much for joining us all the way from Christopher Newport University, all around the States, right? Where else have you been chatting?
Oh, gosh, this week has been a great week. I went to D.C. for election night, then up to New York City for a post, for an interesting panel up there about 2020, and to Philly for the same topic. So it's been a great week.
We feel blessed to have you here for the hour. Thank you so much once again. One of the things that I found really interesting about the outcome for the Virginia legislature, the big turnover, the Senate districts. The Democrats had candidates in 36 of the 40 districts. The GOP only put up 25. In the House districts, the Democrats had candidates in 92 of the 100 districts. The GOP only put up candidates in 72 of the districts. How unusual is that compared to previous election years? And why is that such a mismatch?
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, my research is adding some new innovations into something that is a longstanding, observed, and, you know, much-researched political phenomenon, wave elections, right? And there's many ways you can see a wave coming, and these are pretty standard fare. And one of the ones is that one party will have a massive advantage in candidate recruitment, and that's powered by an underlying belief that that party, their party, is going to have an electoral advantage that cycle. So recruiting candidates to run is easier for the party that's going to be, that's seen to have an advantage, right? So, you know, I was at the panel in New York City, and someone's like, you know, how much of the effects in Virginia and Kentucky are you know, affected by Trump, and, you know, I'm 100%, you know. And other, let me put it this way. If Hillary Clinton was president right now, Democrats would not control the House of Representatives in D.C., and they would not control the Virginia General Assembly. That's how important, you know, that is. So when I was putting out my election forecasting stuff, I kept talking about fundamentals, the number of candidates Democrats were able to field compared to Republicans, the amount of money and how easy it was for them to get money both in and out state. You know, those are things that you can just tell people are understand there's this massive enthusiasm advantage feeding in to the state that's going to power the election outcomes.
So save your money and don't bother?
No, no, not at all. I mean, you know, that's not how elections work, number one. Very few people have as antiseptic election analysis outlook as I do, number one. Because keep in mind, my analysis and my forecasting work is candidate blind. I don't even consider the candidates, right? So, you know, most people don't see election.
Well, I wasn't looking, wasn't talking about your input. I was talking about somebody who's thinking about running. And they're thinking about running.
I mean, we see this play out all the time. I mean, look, think about last year. Okay, so the media narrative is, oh, you know, the Republicans ran Corey Stewart and he got hammered and they couldn't avoid nominating him and he got hammered in the general election. Okay, well, I mean, that's one way to look at it. But the fact of the matter is, Corey Stewart won the nomination because he was the runner-up in the previous effort to win the nomination, and he had highest name recognition, and because there was no other high-profile Republican willing to go through the grueling horrors of running for office. Because I got to tell you, listeners, you know, we do a lot of hate on our elected officials, but there is nothing worse than running for office. It is a, you know, 20-hour day for months. Humiliating experience. It takes massive amounts of energy and investment. And so the big people that could have given Tim Kaine a real race were like Eric Cantor, the former House majority leader, maybe Barbara Comstock, who was, you know, up there in a congressional seat in Northern Virginia. People like that didn't run in 2018 because they knew the electoral environment writ large was favorable only to the Democrats and not to the Republicans, right? So it has this selective, yes, so you're exactly right, don't run, right? In 2021, let me explain it this way. Let's say I'm right and a Democrat wins the White House in 2020. The sense is going to be then at that point that this massive advantage for Democrats is going to roll back. And now maybe two-party competition statewide is possible for Republicans. And you're going to see in that 2021 race a lot more interest from really top-tier talented Republicans, right? And just by having those people enter the race, you're naturally going to have a much more competitive general election because now you're talking about top-tier talent.
Again, our guest today is Rachel Bitticoffer from Christopher Newport University. She's the assistant director at the Wasson Center for Public Policy. So you mentioned the 2021 race. This year's race, the 2019 race, under court-drawn anti-gerrymandering maps, 2021 races be under the 2021 census, correct?
Yes. Yeah, so the situation with the maps is this. The legislature, the way that Virginia law requires anything that's handled through the Constitution requires a amendment to the Constitution, state constitution, and it has to pass through two sessions, separate back-to-back sessions of the General Assembly. the last session, during Republican control, a modification to the way redistricting is handled passed through the General Assembly that will take power away from the state assembly and the governor and make it more, you know, less partisan. It's not perfect by any means, but less partisan. So ostensibly, the 2021 census and reapportionment process, when the redistricting happens, we will have maps that are drawn more equitably in terms of the partisan distribution, okay? Because right now we have maps that are drawn to favor Republicans because Republicans were in charge of the map drawing process, just like if we were in New York, the maps would be drawn to favor Democrats, right? And on top of all of that, of course, those maps were challenged for a decade in court. It takes a decade to challenge those maps, and there was a racial gerrymander. An unconstitutional racial gerrymander ruled in the Hampton Roads area under those maps that was invalidated for this particular election cycle. But that's only going to be in play for this one cycle because the new maps should be implemented. So my expectation is, because of the passion, this is number one, is an issue in our Wasson Center polling that has just been really fascinating because it's extraordinarily complex and voters are not traditionally good at complexity in public policy. And yet the public over the last 10 years has become extremely knowledgeable about gerrymandering. And it has widespread bipartisan support for reform. So it's not an issue that comes down Republicans versus Democrats or vice versa. And so I expect because this is so universally supported, and particularly Democratic activists have pushed so hard for these reforms, that the Democratic legislature, because it now is going to be controlled by Democrats, they're going to be under a lot of pressure to push through something. Now, will it be the second round of this Republican version of reform? I don't know. I don't know if it's going to be that, because if they do it the second time, of course, it will become, you know, moving forward to become law. But I know for sure a gerrymander reform package is going through that General Assembly. I don't think Democrats would be keen to cross the activist part of the base in terms of failing to deliver something on that.
So help me understand this. The opportunity, if 2020 census comes by,
yeah,
and the Democratic legislature has the chance to redraw.
Right.
They're going to do this through fairness that they always talk about? Or are they going to do this to their benefit like they've always claimed that the Republican Party has always used?
Right. Well, to be clear, I mean, the maps were drawn in a way to benefit the Republican Party's power, right, as Democrats do in Maryland to benefit their power. That's why bipartisan consensus amongst voters is so high to reform partisan gerrymandering, and people just hate it, right? So will Democrats draw the maps or come up with a system that still favors them? I don't know. But it won't be, I do know this, they won't be able to use the old system in which they simply draw lines, through the old system where the state legislature draws the lines and the majority party has the power to do what they want to do. And of course, you know, that's going to make a huge difference. Now, here's the thing about fair maps. Fair maps give Democrats an advantage in, you know, the district lines, because generally speaking, when you're drawing maps to be, you know, there's two ways to focus on map drawing. You can do compactness. You can do like a county type maps. Generally speaking, you have to distort a map's geography a bit in order to get a preferred partisan outcome one way or the other. So if you're pursuing a map based on something like that, you're probably going to produce a map that's going to, at the end of the day, produce a different outcome than what we currently have in terms of seat shares for Republicans and Democrats. And I would assume that people will see that as unfair, you know. So for me, though, as a political scientist, especially somebody who studies political polarization and in a normative way would like to see political polarization mitigated because it's crippling our system, for me, the reform that I would like to see the legislature take, and I think we should do this nationwide, is to draw maps to heighten or maximize competitiveness, which is a normative imposition. It's basically gerrymandering to force as many seats into competition as possible. That would have a profound impact on our political system.
Interesting. As a gambler, I'm all for that.
That's what that would be like. That now neither party wants that reform, you know. But I do, and the reason why is because, you know, in the 70s, before we really started hacking these maps apart, all right, there's 435 House seats, okay? They all go up for election every 2 years. And in the modern environment, you know, the ones that are competitive are constantly in election mode because it's, you know, we just live in an election cycle permanently now. But in the last few decades, through this notion that with technology and micro-targeting and demographic data, we can now know exactly where everybody lives and how they vote. So, you know, with the 2000 and 2010 redistricting and reapportionments, the parties began to carve districts in a way to get outcomes based on maximizing their party's power in the state. And Republicans did this in their states that they had power in. Democrats did this in the states they had power in. It's a bipartisan, you know, power grab. And the end result of this, though, unfortunately for us, Americans writ large, is that we dropped from about 160 House seats that were theoretically capable of flipping over in an election to about, you know, tops 60, and that's about 12-13% of the House of Representatives. And what that means in a day-to-day way is there's only about 15% of all people, all 435 of those puppies running around the halls of the Congress, who are electorally incentivized to be cooperative with each other. The others, the 85% others, actually have the opposite electoral incentive, right? Their electoral incentive is to be uncooperative, because if they are cooperative, the electorate that they fear is not the general electorate. It's not independents and, you know, Republicans and Democrats, everybody. It's the primary electorate. It's just Republicans or just Democrats. And if they behave in a way that is cooperative, that does advance public policy and does solve the country's problems and does it in a way that no one's going to be super happy, but at least things are getting done, they will get punished by drawing a primary challenger, and they will get kicked out. And that's what we have seen in each succeeding session election cycle, is all of these moderates just getting wiped out. And so we don't have a functional Congress anymore because of those.
Our guest today, Professor Rachel Bitticoffer. She's the Assistant Director at the Wasson Center for Public Policy, Christopher Newport University, joining us by telephone today at the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We're going to take our second break. We're going to be right back. Don't go anywhere. And we're back in action. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to our show today with our guest, Dr. Rachel Bitticoffer. Dr. Bitticoffer, questions about that are related to some of the anti-gerrymandering maps. You seem surprised as to, or maybe not surprised, actually you, but why did the Democrats do so well in Northern Virginia but underperform in Virginia Beach? Talk about that.
Oh, I'm so glad that you're going to, you know, slow pitch that softball right up to me, because as you just pointed out, I'm the only one that's not surprised about that. I've been for weeks pointing out that Democrats were likely to drop those easily winnable Senate and House races in Virginia Beach based under my forecasting work, because the difference between down there, so number one, you know, if anyone's interested, this obviously is an article written before the election, but you can go onto the Lawson Center website and find it. It's called High Stakes in Virginia's State Legislative Elections, where I break down the partisan competition of each of these competitive races. And, you know, many of the Northern Virginia districts, number one, have slight Democratic leans. They did in 2017, and then, you know, and they did obviously here in 2019 because they were not affected by the redraw. And in terms of why they had been held by Republicans, you know, they just hadn't had that enthusiasm burst, and once it was introduced, it became safe Democratic districts. And a lot of people anticipated that they were going to be close up there with the defending those seats. I thought the whole time, you know, these seats are easily going to be defended. The problem for Democrats is going to be these pickup seats down in Hampton Roads, because although the redistrict made them competitive, many of them remained slightly positive Republican seats. And the difference, the key difference between Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads is the rates of college education within these districts, which college education is the second most important element of my forecasting work. And to put that into perspective, like a Northern Virginia district, it might be a 60% college education rate up there. And down in Hampton Roads, the Senate districts were looking about 40% college educated. And college education is a massive, major predictor of voting, particularly in something like a state legislative election, in which we know historically 30% of registered voters had been participating in. And so I had been, tweeting constantly that I believed Democrats were, you know, likely to leave those on the table, because the, way that conventional wisdom talks about winning elections is about persuading independents. Well, those are important elements. There's about, 5 or 6% of voters in a off year election that are pure, what we call pure independents. They don't lean. When you ask an independent, do you lean to the Republican or Democratic Party? If they say, I lean Republican or Democrat, when you look at their behavior in terms of vote choice and issue preferences, generally speaking, they are going to behave with the party that they lean. So they aren't operationally different than a actual, like, admitted partisan. So I call them closet partisans, right, or embarrassed partisans. but there are some that say, no, I don't lean. And so about that 5%, you know, those are important, persuadable voters. But what's much more important, and this is the way that my research breaks and is shaking up the status quo, and this is really driving a lot of the media attention I'm getting, is that I argue it's actually turnout, especially for the Democrats, because that's the part that, you know, they're the ones that have the ebb and flow problem. It's turnout of these coalitional voters. It's at least as important as the vote choice of that small group of swing voters, and turnout not just of Democrats, but also independents that lean with Democratic voters. And so I expected the Democrats would have a turnout issue in Virginia Beach, and that's exactly what happened. And it left them just kissing the door of flipping those seats, but failing ultimately to flip them over. And those were winnable races. They should have flipped them all. So it's definitely a product of their inept campaign strategy down there.
In leading up to Election Day, President Trump visited Mississippi and he visited Kentucky, but he didn't visit Virginia. Vice President Pence did. Why didn't President Trump come to Virginia?
So here's what my thought is on this, and I have no inside information. So here's, number one, Trump, when you're talking about Kentucky and you're talking about Mississippi, you're talking about states with heavy partisan advantages, registration advantages for Republicans. And again, you know, what's driving my research is this argument that although partisanship has always been important, partisanship now is almost a perfect predictor of vote choice, even if that person, party's candidate, has flaws, scandals, allegations of child abuse in the past, whatever it might be, if they've got the R or D next to their name, that party's voters are going to support them. So in the trick for Republicans to win in Kentucky or Mississippi is simply just get your voters to the polls, right? And getting Trump there is a way to stimulate an enthusiasm advantage and get Republicans out to vote. People in the media say, oh, Trump went to Kentucky and that cost Bevin the election. I look at it and say, no, Trump went to Kentucky and it was almost enough for Bevin to win the election, because he probably would have lost by more had Trump not gone to Kentucky, because Bevin is uniquely unpopular due to the fact that he literally took health insurance away from like 30,000 Kentuckians, right? And that's not good politics at the end of the day. Taking health insurance away from people is usually what we call a third rail in terms of winning electoral politics. So knowing that the suburbs were going to have massive turnout surges amongst Democrats and Democratic Indies, which is exactly what we saw in the suburbs of Louisville and the other city in Kentucky. I mean, we saw 30,000 voters in those cities in 2015, 100,000 voters in each of those cities in 2019. They really needed massive turnout of Republicans everywhere, and they almost did it. We fell 5,000 votes short. So why didn't Trump come to Virginia? My guess is Trump wanted to come to Virginia, and they managed to convince him not to. And the reason is because Virginia has that national security military vote. And as you well know, I mean, unless you're ignoring the impeachment details, this particular scandal that he's caught up with is very problematic in terms of national security issues. And I think that they pushed very hard to keep him in particular away.
Our guest today is Dr. Rachel Bitticoffer. She is the assistant director at the Wasson Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University. So happy to have her here. I've got so many questions that we're not going to be able to fit in the last 10 minutes of the program. Dr. Bitticoffer, a record number of women candidates running for General Assembly this year, and the first female House of the Speaker, correct?
Yes, I mean, I just tweeted about that last night. I mean, this is really something I think all Virginians can celebrate regardless of the, you know, partisan aspects, you know, 400 years of our assembly, which is just, such a lucky and rich history compared to many other states, which don't have as long of a historical evolution. And, you know, we just made a female Speaker of the House, and to follow that up, an African-American female House Majority Leader, which is history-making for the state. Certainly, I'm sure Republicans see that a little bit more, dampened than Democrats can because of the partisan implications, but it's certainly something for the state to recognize.
What do you see as being the top work, the top laws that will be worked on in the 2020 General Assembly?
Oh, that's a perfect closing question. We just went into the field with our new General Assembly. We run a State of the Commonwealth survey every year that comes out in January. It looks at issues that are going to go before the General Assembly in that session. And it was great fun to write this because, you know, we generally don't have to tweak it too much. And this year was a total overhaul, right? I mean, because it's really going to be just so fundamentally different now with Democrats having a governing trifecta. So we added in questions about decriminalization of marijuana. We added in questions about gun control. I mean, we have those questions in, but I guess there's a new, different urgency to them, because I expect Democrats are going to be taking up the issue of that background check bill, which has continually polled in the 80s. Now that it's going to be a political reality, it'll be interesting to see if opinion amongst Republicans shifts at all, because we have had you know, above majority support among Republican voters on that question for a long time, the last couple of years in that survey. So it'll be interesting now that it's going to become something that's probably tangibly achievable, whether that's going to change. My expectation is it might, right? And then we have the redistricting question. So we have question asking, we've been tracking long-term, you know, the attitudes of that, but now we have a question asking about whether Democrats should pass the bill that was passed last year. So I expect that's going to be an issue. The minimum wage, Virginia's at the federal floor. I think we're one of just 15 states that are at the federal floor still. Even West Virginia is at $8.75 an hour. So I think minimum wage is definitely going up in Virginia. So there's going to be a lot of, I think it's going to be a really different picture up there in Richmond this January. It's going to be a session to watch.
What about one of the questions that has come up here is, isn't Virginia the last, or that's not true, not the last, wouldn't Virginia be the last state needed for the ERA vote?
Yes, and I did leave that off, but we do have a question in there, of course, about whether, you know, Virginia should ratify the ERA. There is, of course, uncertainty that whether or not the it could actually be ratified given the time lapse. But in terms of symbolic effort, you know, I would anticipate, yes, the Democrats will be putting that ratification through the session.
So
it's also widely popular in our data. I mean, up in the 80s for that, too.
So we still have a few minutes left. Our guest is Dr. Rachel Bitticoffer from Christopher Newport University, works around the United States doing this sort of media work on the topic. Very lucky to have her today. You do a class on slogans?
I do a lecture on slogans and a class on campaigns, yeah.
Give me some material on that, please.
Oh, my. Well, it's so hard without the visuals because it's just so great to have them. But, you know, talking about, you know, the great slogans of the past, Reagan, by the way, is the originator of Make America Great. So, you know, Make America Great is a great slogan. It was far superior to the Clinton slogan, which most voters can't even remember from 2016. And it's still a good slogan. It's going to be a good slogan for 2020 as well. But it's not an original. It comes from Ronald Reagan, right? Clinton's slogan of People First in the 1992 campaign, an excellent slogan. Last night on Twitter, I said that Mike Bloomberg, if he's going to run, should reinvigorate the I Like Ike slogan from Eisenhower's run in 52. But he should do I Like Mike, and maybe it would invoke for Americans that, you know, he's independent-ish, and he's, you know, trying to take America back to its, you know, days of you know, independent-type leadership under, you know, Eisenhower. I mean, Eisenhower was a Republican, but a traditional liberal-type Republican. So, you know, I think, you know, slogans are so important. If you have a candidate and that an average voter knows the slogan for, you're going to have a winner.
All right. Do you think that the impeachment inquiry had any role or how much of a role it might have played in this last election from Tuesday and how much of a role it might play in the 2020 election?
Yeah, so the impeachment inquiry is rolled up into what I call the Trump effect. I mean, Trump, there was nothing local or state about this 2019 cycle. This is a nationalized election cycle that was about one thing, and that one thing is named Donald J. Trump, right? And so impeachment is just part of that equation. The way the media talks about the impeachment, I mean, my guess is that, you know, we're going to see a trial where a lot of really problematic evidence is going to be presented about the president's behavior on this Ukraine matter. But ultimately, the vote for conviction happens in the Senate, and that Senate's controlled by Republicans, and many, many Republicans, for many of these Republican senators, their voters prefer Trump over them. They like Trump more than they like the Republican senators. So that vote to acquit is, to me, probably a pretty obvious outcome. And the way that I see that playing out is that that is, you know, probably going to placate Republican voters for the most part, who are going to vote in big numbers. They voted in big numbers in 2018. They voted in big numbers in 2019. Republicans are going to vote, but so are Democrats, and there's just more of them in many, many places. We have a realignment going on where rural places are moving to the right and suburban and urban places are moving to the left. And, you know, there are suburban places everywhere. They're in Wisconsin, they're in Michigan, they're in Pennsylvania. They didn't exercise their muscle in 2016, but they're going to flex it in 2020 for sure. And my guess is after the Senate acquits Trump for this Ukraine matter, which, you know, if you look at the evidence, is not just about a transcript, which is, by the way, problematic also for the president. It's much more than that. There's going to be a big chunk of the country that's not going to be happy with the Republican Party after that vote.
Just 1 minute left before we need to finish up. Will taking the inquiry public and on television for citizens to actually finally see people telling their story, even though it may not change the senators and their vote, will it change the citizens and how they may vote?
So the problem is, this is not the 1970s. So in the 1970s, the presidency was sick, okay? The system was healthy, but the presidency had a sickness, all right, a corruption sickness. Now the entire system is sick, and I think that the public's going to do, you know, a good chunk of the public will do what, you know, Lindsey Graham said he's going to do, which is just simply not look at the evidence.
All right. Dr. Rachel Bitticoffer from Christopher Newport University has been our guest today. Professor, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
All right. And Sunday morning wake-up call. Next week, we'll have a professor on from University of Virginia to talk about the history of clothing. How did men wear ties? Why do men wear ties? Why do women wear bikinis? And a lot more than that. Take care, everyone.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Engineering assistance was by Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.